Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Oh man, do we have something special for you tonight. I hinted about it last Sunday and told you you'd want to tune in tonight, since last week we were privileged to uncork a pretty big news story, one that's already reverberated around the world and is now just picking up steam as the world trickles out. Las Vegas businessman Robert Bigelow announced a few days ago the creation of BICS, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies, which was created to promote the study of consciousness, how it all fits together, in particular, what it means to the ultimate question of human existence: what happens when we die? Do we go on in some form? Do we survive physical death? Are we immortal, as many religions believe? Is it something that can be studied by science? There are scattered pockets of academic research into survival of consciousness around the world, but for the most part, the public doesn't hear much about it, and there's very little coordination between the different camps. Also, very little financial support. Mr. Bigelow is putting up more than $1 million for BICS, including just shy of $1 million to be awarded later this year, split up among the top three essays to be submitted to BICS. It's been more than 7 years since Robert was here on Coast, and in the interim, he's been a very busy guy, carrying out a secretive study of UFOs and the paranormal at a place called Skinwalker Ranch and around the world, part of a very broad contract he signed with the Pentagon, specifically with the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. Until a few days ago, he's never spoken publicly about that effort, about the OSAP study, about BASS, his subsidiary company, about the Tic Tac UFO or ATIP or the bizarre events on the Skinwalker Ranch. Tonight, we cover all of that, plus his take on the state of the space program, on NASA, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and what might be next for his own space project, which have cost him around $350 million so far. That conversation starts just a few minutes from now. Then in the second half tonight, we seamlessly transition into another space adventure, the Europa Clipper. That's the name of the craft being designed now. Europa is one of the most likely places in our solar system where life could exist, but NASA has really been on kind of a roller coaster about whether this mission would ever happen. The behind-the-scenes struggle has been like a soap opera, lots of heartache and disappointment. And writer David W. Brown has written a masterpiece about the highs and lows of this program, what it can mean for our understanding of whether we're alone or not. That's coming up less than 2 hours from now. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have gathered our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from the world's news media. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. I won't go through all the stories because we want to get right to Robert Bigelow. Among the items you might want to check out, a news report we aired this last week that puts in a nutshell what the BICS project is all about: consciousness, what we know and what we don't, and a think piece about whether now is a good time to spill all the beans about UFOs, disclosure of some kind or another. That and more in Knapp's News. And while you're there on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day. If you subscribe for a year, gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. Another great deal on the site is Beyond Belief. That's George Norrie's television program, which covers content similar to what George does here on the radio. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the chuckwalla. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into the flannel jammies and your toes into the fluffy bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio. In a moment, is there proof of an afterlife? With my guest, Robert Bigelow. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. My first guest tonight is well known to our listeners, even though he hasn't done many interviews in recent years and even fewer interviews on camera. The New York Times unleashed an insightful profile of Robert Bigelow in its Sunday edition today, written by Ralph Blumenthal. He was one of the three journalists who broke that huge story back in December 2017 about the Tic Tac and the Pentagon program called ATIP, which studied military encounters with UFOs, now called UAPs. Mr. Bigelow is a space entrepreneur who founded and funded his own space program, Bigelow Aerospace, which launched three of its own spacecraft into orbit, one of them attached to the ISS now. He was also the man behind NIDS. The National Institute for Discovery Science has probably spent more money to support UFO research than any person in history, owned the Skinwalker Ranch for 20 years, and signed an agreement with the DIA to study not only UFOs, but also paranormal events that seem connected to the UFO mystery under the umbrella of something called OSAP. Now he's launching a new venture to dive into consciousness, whether or not there is evidence of an afterlife. Robert, welcome back to Coast.
Hey, George. Thank you. It's I had no idea it's been 7 years.
Yes, I had to look it up.
Gosh.
You know, having known you for, it's 31 years now, and being allowed by you to be a fly on the wall for things, you know, confidential things, so many endeavors that you've launched, even I could not report most of it all the time, at least at the time. And it's always amazed me to read things about you on social media. And in articles, you know, you're a mystery man, you're shadowy, you own the Bigelow Tea Company, you're in the casino business, you're studying UFOs so you can control the alien technology and escape the planet. All manner of very dark conspiratorial stuff, and I have to chuckle about it sometimes, knowing you here in Las Vegas, your family, your business and charity activities, all very public and open, and it sort of makes me laugh. And I wonder, do you pay any attention to this at all? Does it even make a dent with you?
I don't know. You know, I just know this, George. There's no way I would buy a used car from that guy. You know, there's no way I would do it.
The New York Times story today, you know, Ralph Blumenthal lays out a lot of your personal history. It's a great piece. The one overriding message to come out of that all is it's that all these seemingly varied interests, UFOs and consciousness and the afterlife and mysterious phenomena, they seem like a bunch of different things. But your experience that we'll talk about tonight, not just recently, but for years, suggests they're all related. Let's start there. Are they? Is there a link between consciousness research and the UFO mystery and some of the weird experiences that you and your family and your employees have had? And if so, when did this first start occurring for you?
Well, that's a mouthful. let's see, you've commingled two or three things here. And let's start with whether or not, what might be the interconnectedness and the similarities between the two topics. And I think, you know, you have well-documented stories about people in crowds that some can see a certain object in the sky in that crowd and others cannot, and that seems to suggest there could be a consciousness connection there. Also, you have many anecdotal stories about people that were viewing a unidentified object in the sky, and it started to drift away, and they were thinking, "Gee, I wish it wouldn't just leave just yet." And it reverses itself. So you have various examples that suggest that there is consciousness connection on a superficial level. It may be also that it's more than just superficial. And so I think there is a connection. I'm not sure exactly the extent of it. I don't know that anybody knows that. You know, how extensive is that consciousness signature and connection? But there are many different kinds of ways that you can identify situations in which it seems to occur.
For you, what you've called the Holy Grail questions, the two big questions, are we alone, and what happens when we die? These occur to you at a very young age because of things that happen in your family. And even though they seem to be unrelated, looking at the big picture, you think they might have there's a connection between them. Maybe we can run through some of those.
Sure. Well, you know, when I was about, I guess it starts with when I was about 3 years old, my grandparents, which by the way, I lived next door to, from the time I was about three or so years of age to maybe where I was about 18, and then went away to school. But when I was three, they had a very close encounter, and we've talked about that many times. And it was an event that was so profound for my grandfather, he would never talk to me about it, and my grandmother would only, little bits and pieces, would say something, and I didn't even find out about the story until I was about 10, 10 years of age maybe, 9 or 10, somewhere in that time frame. Through my mother, she told me about it, and then she and my grandparents had a daytime sighting of a large craft over what's called the Sheep Mountain Range, north of Las Vegas, and so I had friends who had they kept very close to the vest in their families. They wouldn't discuss things except for maybe somebody else who was a close friend, like I was to a couple of fellows, and they might say, you know, so and so saw this, and I saw this and that, and we were out on a hunting trip, and we stopped our truck, and this craft was there over in the desert, I was exposed to different sources about close encounters and sightings in the Las Vegas area in that kind of time frame.
And this is 1947 when your grandparents had this. It was a pretty momentous date in UFO history.
Yeah, it was. It was, time of Ken Arnold and Roswell, and their sighting was somewhere in the mid-May time frame of 47. There was a coincidence or relationship or whatever to the timing of when a lot of these kinds of events were being seen.
Looking back at it now, you suspect that maybe your grandparents had something beyond just a sighting, that there might be some missing time there that had a profound impact on them and that they just didn't want to talk about it.
Well, you know, in the UFO research area, you have many slices of the pie to go after and to pursue in research, and abductions is one of the areas that I've spent a lot of time in and sat in during regression hypnosis sessions with people like Bud Hopkins and other folks, so I would say that because they arrived back in Las Vegas very late, I was told by my mother that my grandfather had to kind of recoup himself to be able to drive the car because the event was so profound. They both thought they were going to die, and from an impact, the craft filled up the entire windshield and then zipped off to the side. I think there might have been more to that. There's a possibility. I have no way of knowing, but I wish I had a chance and been able to talk to him more and talk to him at all, really, and have the information about abductions that I have today when I was 10 years old. So, you know, just one of those things about timing.
So this is before there was television here in Las Vegas. You're not watching programs about alien abductions or even UFOs at that time, but you start having a series of dreams that, looking back, may have been more significant than you thought at the time.
Well, you know, I kept that to myself all my life. I didn't even tell my wife that about those, you know, half dozen different dreams I had as a kid, because they made no sense. I was probably, 7 years of age, somewhere in that vicinity. I just have always kept it as I had just peculiar, nondescript dreams that were boring, that were repetitive, and nothing happened. And I couldn't associate them with anything, with comic books or movies. That's about all we had back in, the 50, 51, 52 time frame. And so that was pretty much all we had to entertain ourselves with.
In these dreams, you're having little men in your room, right?
Yeah, I'm laying sideways on a twin bed in my bedroom, and the bed's shoved up against a wall in a corner of the room, I wake up, and the dreams were always the same stupid dreams where I'm looking over and I'm seeing maybe three three little figures, and I can't distinguish any facial features of any kind or appendages other than they had a human form, and they were dressed in something, clothed in something like a monk's garb, where you couldn't see hands or face or anything of that sort, and they just stood there. And so I'm looking at them, they're looking at me, and that's it. And it was the same dream over and over. And to this day, I have no idea that it's nothing more than dreams. I don't know.
So the idea of UFOs, alien visitors, is imprinted on your young brain. And then the issue of consciousness and the afterlife pops up multiple times through some personal losses. I mean, you had to confront the idea of death multiple times in your life. You haven't really liked talking about that either, but it directly leads to Bix, what we're going to discuss in a bit.
Yeah, I lost my father when I was 18 to a private plane crash, and where he was a passenger in a plane that his partner owned, and then my wife and I lost our first child in 92, and actually it was our second son, and then we lost our grandson in about 2011. So by that time, I had been doing study and research in consciousness, in survival. And I have to say, it was comforting to be able, I went through a lot of literature, a lot of books, and visited a few mediums, maybe three. And I think one or two were a little helpful. And the literature was very helpful because I kind of coalesced a lot of different kinds of sources. And, you know, from a religious perspective, this is not everybody's cup of tea by any means. You know, it's almost kind of blasphemy in some religious sectors to consider that you have a spirit, you have a soul, and you may have an existence beyond today. And, of course, a lot of other religions embrace it fully. And they each and all of them have their own notional ideas as to what the other side is all about. But it's a big step even getting to the point to where does it even exist? And for me, by that time, I was fairly sure there was something there. And it was comforting for those losses that it was very comforting.
So your father, your son, your grandson, and a year ago, your wife of, I think you were married for 55 or 56 years, Diane.
Right.
You are motivated to try to establish, A, do we go on, and B, can we communicate with the other side, right?
Yeah, from personal, not only from a kind of a scientific, exploratory kind of curiosity, you know, which is the kind of the birth location of a lot of things people are driven to do, maybe out of curiosity, and then the deeper you get into something, the more substance that you discover that something has, and in both of these fields, the ET UFO field and the survival of consciousness field are so vast and so fantastic that if you just take the time and the trouble and the effort to read the literature, to go ahead and make some sensible choices as to what it is you're going to read, you know, not read just goofy stuff, but read stuff that has been well done, well researched, it's pretty hard to just throw it away and say, oh, there's nothing there. If you're you know, a thinker and try to connect the dots, and you have, you know, you don't just take at first glance everything as being totally factual. So you need to have a little bit of Doubting Thomas in you and not just fall for every story and every incident that you come across. But after a while, it begs the question of what is it by coming up with answers, you know, traditional scientific excuses or answers like swamp gas. Which J. Allen Hynek was forced to promote as a mechanism that produced phenomena, you know, and so I'm kind of frustrated by folks who would be in denial and not even produce the effort and the time and the energy to go and investigate.
Well, we're going to get into your pending investigation, what you hope to accomplish with BIX, what people need to do to enter this competition. We're talking with Robert Bigelow. We're talking with Robert Bigelow about BIX, the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies, and $1 million, nearly $1 million in prizes he will award later this year to the top three entrants in an essay contest supporting the idea that there is evidence for an existence of an afterlife. In a moment, we talk to Robert about the rules of the contest and the ultimate purpose of BIX in finding answers to the big question, a central question to human existence. Robert, at a young age, you had these indelible experiences, your family's experiences with a close encounter and your dreams, and then and later in life, the losses, personal losses, that had you at a young age deciding to make some money so that you could personally pursue these huge subjects, right?
Yeah, I was I was hooked by the time I was 12 or 13 years old on the UFO ET subject at that time, and I thought, wow, you know, if even a small fraction of this is true, that's absolutely incredible. It defies all of our physics. I mean, it was obvious, you know, even then that it didn't fit. It didn't fit our science. It didn't fit anything. And so, yeah, I was hooked at that early age and made a commitment to try to do what I could to find ways to make some money and then pursue it.
And, you know, people think of NIDS, the organization you created in the mid-90s, and they think associate it with UFOs, but they tend to forget that NIDS actually had two primary missions in the beginning. So you made good on that promise. You created your own organization to investigate these two Holy Grail questions, right?
Yeah, we our eyes were bigger than our stomach, and so our appetite was too aggressive, and to try to go after both of those subjects and those pillars, the both of those Holy Grails at the same time was too much. Even though we had a large science advisory board, and even better, we had fabulous people that populated that science advisory board, we eventually came to a point where we had to make a choice. And the majority of the group decided to go after ET and UFOs, and I think probably it was because virtually every participant on that board, in one way or another, had their own personal reasons for being there, whether it was conscious survival work or ET work, and I think more of them had, my guess is, something more profound that pushed them into the UFO topic, and that's how we bifurcated the group and focused on the ET research.
Back then, maybe it seemed like two questions, but did you suspect that they were actually one question or interrelated? And I ask it in the context of, you know, the entities that have been reported, like at the ranch, the UFO entities that you have investigated at various times under different programs, and these spiritual entities, the you know, do we go on kind of a thing? Are they the same thing? Are these ETs or ultra-terrestrials or discarnate entities, or are they the same?
Yeah, so at the beginning of NIDS, we were not aware, at least I wasn't, I don't think staff was, potential similarities or connections even between the two topics. And it wasn't until maybe through various experiments at the ranch and very observations at the ranch that they began to manifest that there was some crossover of some kind. And, you know, and thought, basically what we're talking about here is the kind of the dichotomy between the material existence of a brain and the difference between that and mind, which in the vernacular of consciousness studies are two different things. And And so then it gets into aspects of thought, and what kind of power is there through human thought, and even communication, and you're not exactly sure with whom you're communicating in various kinds of ways. And if you get into the entire basket of psi, right, clairvoyance, micro, macro, PK, remote viewing, on and on and on, you submerge yourself very quickly into the effects upon things or the gathering of information strictly on the basis of thought. And you should have no other, no means, no traditional means through the normal five senses of acquiring the information you just acquired, especially with remote viewing, for example, or moving an object, you know, through macro PK, or even subatomic particles on a computer screen with micro PK. And that's so well documented with Bob John and Brenda Dunn. And there's so much literature on that. So all of these things are cousins in some way that are thought-driven, that are mind-driven. You can have somebody whose brain is dead, but they should not be able to recall all of the information that while they were brain dead that they are able to retrieve. So what is the mind? What is that separation? And how, you know, we don't have a physics. Our physics is so incomplete and so immature, and for some reason, you know, virtually none of the schools in this country delve into this area. I'm not even sure they would even know how to. And so this area is part of maybe not just a field, but multiple fields that we really understand very little about.
Well, that leads us to BICS. What is BICS? What is it intended to do? And talk about the first project, the essay contest.
Well, BICS, Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies, is simply it's a research. First and foremost, we are interested in doing research to try to learn, and we're students. And the aspect of being a student never ends; it's perpetual, and so we're trying to do something that helps to expand the research and the understanding of the topic, and maybe we will get into helping to facilitate other people in different kinds of ways. The contest is a means of just stirring the pot, trying to produce interest, and you know, I think we're hopefully going to be able to generate some really interesting essays. Have to be 25,000 words or less that attempt to produce features you would call evidence or proof. Quote, beyond a reasonable doubt, unquote, which is satisfactory for all the American court system and all the court systems in the Western world and even beyond the Western world. And so that ought to be good enough. It doesn't mean that you have to be 100% sure, but you have to have some conviction that's at least beyond reasonable doubt and that something exists. And so we're saying, geez, some of these essays might be fabulous. And maybe people will read some of these essays and find an encapsulated dialogue and description that will cause them to start to think and wonder and start to read other material and help to expand the field.
So you want to stimulate thought and research around the globe. You want to encourage people to dig into this and think about it. And I guess also to have people come out of the weeds. There could be all kinds of research underway in small little pockets around the globe that you never heard about before.
Well, yeah, and we know that that exists. We know that there are various folks that are involved in certain kinds of things, and they're in a kind of a sub rosa mode. They're not. They're trying to keep it quiet, and what some of the folks are doing is astounding, and what they're receiving is astounding, in multiple kinds of ways. But it's an awful lot to digest just at one. You know, you can't start. You can't start at warp speed. You need to try to gather up the momentum and start to delve into it to where you get a little bit more comfortable. I don't know about you, George, but I remember when I first started into the ET research, it was at first it was a lot to digest. There was so much, and it was so amazing and astounding that you had to start to learn to get comfortable with the phenomena. And, of course, you've got your daily life, so you can't let it consume you, you know, in terms of you need to have kind of a foot solid based on the ground and another foot where, you're kind of exploring this nebulous topic and when you're first getting into it. And I think conscious survival is similar. It is really amazing. The more and more that you dig into it and you explore it, the more holy cow it becomes.
Yeah, it's a huge learning curve for both of those subjects. And I can remember diving into UFOs to begin with, and you're overwhelmed. The challenge is separating wheat from chaff. Who's credible? What's real? What isn't? And then getting your heads around it. And then when you realize, hey, there's something to this, then you suddenly feel like you want to preach it. You want to share it with people like you're born again or something. And that's what I'm reading the consciousness studies and books at your urging now, and it's the same kind of discovery process. Tell me what might constitute a winning entry: $500,000 first prize, $300,000 second prize, $150,000 third prize. You'd think that would generate a lot of entries, but what will be the winning entry? What kind of evidence would you accept?
Well, it can't be just a matter of quoting scripture for obvious reasons. First, what scripture is going to be the scripture? There are many, 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 many different religions, and every one of them has their own philosophy and their own rules of the order of things, and so it means having some other way of producing proof. Satisfactory beyond a reasonable doubt the other side exists, and it is the territory of religion. And we're perfectly fine with priests and reverends and ministers and rabbis and so on entering the contest. Just don't quote us, you know, the Quran or the Bible or whatever, and say that supports why you're entering this contest. That's good. That's not good enough, because anybody can do that. That's not good enough. You have to come up with something else more profound. And again, if you read any of the literature we began to rebuild. I have an extensive library that I had put together years ago on both consciousness and UFOs, about 4,000 books, and I still have I have in, and that is that library is scattered in about three or four different locations, but we had to go out, and when we started BIX, we had to go out and find what is the best literature of today. And we purchased about 150 select texts from about July to up to about a month ago, and so we're kind of overwhelmed with, like, we try to grab what time we can to delve into the literature and try to find commonalities and so forth, but I guess the point is that there's a lot of information out there that is collaborated by multiple investigators, multiple authors, and you could see where you could evolve a really good paper a really good essay through an amalgamation of these different kinds of sources. And, of course, it really helps, which, if you have personal experiences, that's huge. If you have multiple witnesses, that's even larger. And depending upon who the witnesses were, is really significant. So I can't really sit here and tell you what the judges are going to do. I have, that's up to the five judges. And I suspect they may not have an easy time trying to make the selection.
So, for example, near-death experiences, a lot of really interesting work being done on that topic here and there. Leslie Cain was my recent guest on the program, and we talked about her series on Netflix. But near-death experiences, that would be the kind of thing that might qualify as a winning essay, because there are some remarkable cases in that research.
Yeah, I think when you start to find ways of acquiring information, when all the doors are closed and locked as to the choices of how you could acquire this information by various means, and you wind up with only one open door, and you're really sure of that open door, and you reaffirm multiple times, and with other different situations like that, and you keep acquiring information under certain kinds of investigatory procedures and ways of working at this, that you shouldn't acquire, then something else is afoot. Something else is going on besides the traditional explanations. And the traditional explanations start to get really goofy and ridiculous at some point, to where it's like Occam's razor. The only logical answer then is the one that's staring you in the face in the first time, And so I don't know. I think that I'm hopeful that we're going to get some really good essays, and we want to put them up on our website. We want people to be able to read these things and just for a moment set a predisposed conviction aside, just for a moment, just out of curiosity, to read what people have written and wonder, is there anything to it? Is there any substance whatsoever to the topic based on what you're reading from these essays?
Near-death experiences, reincarnation cases, that would constitute a form of evidence if you could document somebody had been here before, I would think.
Oh, those are huge. Yeah. Those are, people have spent their entire lives on either one of those topics. They're in many, many decades. People, Ian Stevenson, he was a tremendous, he was an icon in his time, and his seminal book, 22 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, he'd investigated about 2,000, and then especially the book on children is phenomenal, two-year-olds and three-year-olds, having information about things that there's no way that they should be able to have any of that information at all. Combination numbers to a safe in a village that they've never been to, and neither have their parents or grandparents, because people just didn't travel. And lo and behold, the child knows the combination to the safe in this woman's house. And
all right. Robert, I got to take a break. We'll come back, finish up our conversation about Bix, then move on to some other subjects, talking with Robert Bigelow here on Coast to Coast.